Welcome to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for listening this Friday and supporting public radio. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, this week, Governor Ron DeSantis leveled a new threat against Florida cities and counties. The governor says any Florida municipality that requires its employees to get the COVID-19 vaccine will be fined $5,000 per infraction. Now, places around the state like Tampa and Orange County say they've been planning to do just that. At a news conference Monday, DeSantis said he feels it's wrong that first responders and other government employees could get fired for not getting the vaccine.
People that have put in 10, 15, 20 years, and now they're just going to get cast aside by some onerous mandate. That is wrong. And so we let it be known today. We're going to be enforcing Florida law against that.
Now, the law in question bans private businesses and government agencies from requiring customers to provide proof of vaccination. DeSantis's plan to fine cities could cost them millions. Orange County already has a vaccine requirement. Mayor Jerry Demings announced a mandate that all Orange County employees must be partially vaccinated by September 30th, fully vaxxed by the end of October. Mayor Demings joins us now, along with Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Good to have you both.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right. Good afternoon. This is Jerry Demings.
Good to have you, Mayor Demings. 305-995-1800 tweets to @FloridaRoundup. So, Mayor Demings, what's your reaction to the governor's announcement that he'll fine Orange County for requiring vaccinations of government employees?
Well, we've reviewed the alleged statutory authority that the governor cites under Senate Bill 2006 that was passed by the Florida legislature. And we do not believe that the current law is applicable in this instance. Our county attorney's office has reviewed it and believes that we're on solid ground to be able to do what we have done here as an employer to require our employees under both federal and state law to be mandated to receive the vaccine. And so
we lost more than life. Just for a second, Mayor Demings, but the mayor saying he believes he's on solid ground to mandate vaccination of public employees in Orange County. Nate Monroe of Florida Times Union, the governor is saying for each infraction, he will fine a municipality like Orange County. Let's talk about the political implications of this.
Well, I mean, it's part and parcel of what the governor has been doing really this entire pandemic. Kind of taking an issue that is going to resonate really well with his base, using sort of questionable legal authority, really ramping up the stakes. It's, you know, just kind of ever escalating fights with other public officials. I mean, it's got all the hallmarks of at this point, a very typical sort of DeSantis move.
We've seen the governor do this with Florida school districts. At last count, 13 of them have defied the governor's office on mask mandates for students. Mayor Demings, you've declared a state of emergency in your area, which is prompting your move on requiring vaccinations, correct?
That is correct. At one point, our rate of transmission here within Orange County was very high. It was over 20%. I'm happy to report that today it has declined. We are now at a 14-day average positivity rate of below 13% and declining. So that's the good news. But we believe that we had to take some very decisive action at the local level in order to protect our citizens and certainly our employees. For example, our firefighters and law enforcement officers and other frontline workers don't get to choose what they respond to while we're in this heightened state of emergency as we deal with the pandemic. And so we've tried to be proactive and work on preventative measures by instituting mask mandates for our employees and county facilities, as well as for employees who are being required to be vaccinated. But we've incentivized that. The goal is not to fire any of our employees, but to get the rate of vaccinations up. Unfortunately, we've had a number of our employees who have died of COVID. Some who work within our corrections department, our jail, in other words, here within Orange County. We've had three such employees. We've had other employees, unfortunately, in our employee in Orange County who have also died of COVID-19, who were primarily unvaccinated persons. And so what we're trying to do is get the overall rate of vaccinations up in our county. And I'm happy to report that today of the eligible population, the 12 year of age and older here within Orange County, 72%+ of our residents are now inoculated.
That is good news. So it sounds then, Mayor, as though you're just going to go ahead, and if the state finds you, so be it?
Well, absolutely. I believe that this is an issue that is best resolved in the courts. As an employer, we certainly have the right to give direction to our employees. And when the governor talks often about an overreach of government, what we are seeing here is an overreach of our state government to try to control unnecessarily the actions of local governments. Our job is to protect the life, health, and welfare of our residents and our employees. And whenever the governor interferes in that process, that's problematic. When people in local communities dial 911 for emergency assistance, they don't call the governor's office. They don't call Tallahassee. They don't call Washington, D.C. They call us at the local level. It is our first responders who respond to those calls for service. And to diminish our ability to put appropriate protocols in place for our own employees is being short-sighted. And so this is part of course, but what we have been seeing, unfortunately, out of this governor, where he tries to preempt the authority of local governments and centralize that under his control. Well, that's a dictatorship, and that is really not in the best interest of Americans or Floridians or those who live in local communities.
Nate Monroe, you know, we hear Mayor Deming saying this is a matter of public health. Governor DeSantis earlier this week tried to frame this issue as one of workers' rights. He took some criticism for standing up on the state of Florida podium with a gentleman who spouted some vaccine misinformation as a rationale for not getting vaccinated. The governor says he's trying to protect people's jobs. That's a very different narrative, Nate, from what we're hearing from these mayors and county leaders.
It is. I mean, when you have devoted your ideology to just being a contrarian, you find yourself on some pretty odd sides of issues. I mean, you have seen anti-vaccine advocates echoing language of, pro-choice supporters, hearing Ron DeSantis talk about protecting workers' rights in a state that has very proudly, advocated for at-will employment where employees can be fired for any reason whatsoever. I mean, I think what it speaks to is just a governor who's dedicated to just taking contrarian positions. There's no consistent kind of ideology here. It's just putting your finger, into the wind in any way you sense that, experts and so-called blue states are heading, you just head the other way. It's not a good model for governing.
Let's go to some of your calls here on the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. Howard in Davie, Florida. Howard, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes. In New York, they have vaccine mandates, which are under a TRO by a federal judge. So this could happen here very easily. A TRO for the vaccine mandates in the areas that are contrary to what the governor wants, regardless of its taking the governor's position or the county position. So a TRO is very a strong possibility. I'll take my response off the air, but what are you going to do
do you mean by TRO, Howard?
Temporary restraining order.
Temporary restraining order. Okay. Mayor Demings, what are your thoughts about that and how this compares to what we're seeing in other states?
Well, you can see that here in the state of Florida, the governor and the Florida Department of Health have had to make some quick adjustments, because prior to this week, there were no guidelines that were put in place. There was no system to give guidance to local governments within the state about how to really deal with vaccine mandates, et cetera. And so now they have the burden of promulgating rules about how this is supposed to work. And that had never been communicated to the people here in the state of Florida. And I believe that anytime that you enact the law, in order to enforce it, you have to give adequate notice to the residents and explain what the potential ramifications are. And that really hasn't happened here. And so I know that at the federal level, we have seen the U.S. Supreme Court rule that clearly employers have the legal right to institute mandates of sorts. And then just a week ago, we had the president come out and seemingly give directives that require certain categories of employees to be vaccinated. Here in Orange County, for example, we have physicians that work in our health clinics. We have physicians that work taking care of inmates in our jail. We have nurses, and healthcare workers fit under that category
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, it's a fascinating dynamic but watching this play out with cities now clashing with the governor in the same way school districts have. I hope you'll come back on the show soon as we continue to follow this. I want to thank you, Mayor Jerry Demings, Orange County, and Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Meanwhile, a coalition of local and national media organizations has joined a lawsuit against the DeSantis administration seeking more transparency from the state in releasing COVID data. Outlets asking to join this complaint include the New York Times, Washington Post, Miami Herald, and more. Carlos Guillermo Smith, state representative and Democrat from Orlando, filed the lawsuit. He joins us now, along with Stephanie Colombini, reporter at Health News Florida. Good to have you both. Representative Smith, tell us about this complaint and how it's gaining these new media participants.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. Well, you know, unfortunately, what we've seen, not just in the past year, but especially in the last 3 months, since the DeSantis administration took down the daily COVID-19 dashboard. Of course, that was the platform that so many people were able to log on to and get basic information about how COVID was being transmitted in their own backyard in Florida, hospitalization details, death details, information that Floridians have a constitutional right to see, so that they can make informed decisions to protect the health and safety of their families. All of that went away a few months ago when the dashboard was taken down. So we filed a records request to try to help our local school board members make an informed decision specifically about masking policies as our kids were returning to school, and they couldn't get the data. Unfortunately, the DeSantis administration rejected our request for public records. They claimed that the data we were asking for about local pediatric hospitalizations was confidential, which is totally false, because we're not asking for patient names or social security numbers. We just want raw numbers and answers to basic questions like how many kids are hospitalized with COVID in our area. They refuse to do it, which is not only the bad governance of, you know, this particular administration during an emergency, it's also against the law to not share public records. That's why we're suing them, so that we can obtain those public records. Yeah.
And now media organizations asking for the data too as part of this complaint. Stephanie, you were part of a team at Health News Florida reporting on the inequities in healthcare revealed by this pandemic. How does this lack of access to information that the representative is asking for affect not only the healthcare workers, but the public in general?
Well, you know, it really just makes it that much more difficult to understand the severity of the surge that we're experiencing right now. And some of this data is available elsewhere. You know, we get our daily case rates and hospitalizations from the federal government right now, but you practically need a computer science degree to navigate some of these websites and really find what you're looking for. So for the average person, you know, it was so much easier to be able to just go on the health department website and find those things. So it's definitely more challenging to understand how to protect yourself, whether you should be changing behaviors, if you don't really have a full concept of what's going on in your community, especially losing the localized data, that county by county specific data, or the specific schools, the specific nursing homes. You know, people want to know how this affects them. And when you can't get that grasp, it's harder to know what to do.
Right. Representative Smith, people do want granular data. What's going on in their county, even their neighborhood, their particular school? How much is that part of your action, your complaint?
It's actually right at the center of it. You know, what started all of this was, of course, the need to get local data as it related to forming a smart and science-based school mitigation plans here in Orange County. What the governor is doing by continuing to refuse public records is he's suppressing the severity of the crisis. And we just heard from Mayor Demings, and he made a lot of really important points, which is that if we can't see the specific details about how COVID is being transmitted in our area, for me, it's here in Orlando in Orange County, then how can we put together a plan to be able to respond? There's basic information that we don't have. Now, what we recently saw this week was suddenly the COVID death data for Florida, broken down by county, was finally released. I don't think that that is a coincidence. The DeSantis administration has a pattern of only responding to public records requests after they've been sued. So to me, there's no question that the fact that we have a pretrial hearing Monday at 4 o'clock with Judge Cooper to hear our lawsuit and compel the state to release these public records is certainly one of the reasons we suddenly saw this COVID death data broken down by county released. But it's not everything. It's not everything we've asked
You're
for.
You're still
we've
seeking all... more. If I could get another caller on the air, it's Tyler in Tampa. Go ahead quickly, Tyler.
Hi there. I was wondering what we can do as Florida residents to try and protest against the governor's new plan. It really sounds like it's going to cause a lot of problems for us.
You know, this is a time of political division. Governor DeSantis has fans and detractors. People are welcome to air their views on this show and certainly vote in the next election. Stephanie, you know, we crossed 50,000 deaths from COVID this week here in Florida. So data is more important than ever. In the minute or so we have left, what are your thoughts about that as a healthcare reporter?
Yeah, I was thinking of that example of, you know, imagine if that statistic, that, you know, tragic statistic that we have surpassed 50,000 deaths was revealed in a weekly report dumped, you know, Friday afternoon as everybody's preparing to, you know, live their weekend lives and move on. That wouldn't have really resonated with people. It's having these daily reports to keep people updated each day that really informs people's decisions and behavior. So it's necessary to have as much access to information as possible.
And we'll look, we'll follow along with the next phase in this lawsuit. Thank you, Carlos Guillermo Smith, State Representative, Democrat of Orlando, filing the lawsuit along with media partners, Stephanie Colombini, reporter at Health News Florida, also with us. Thanks to you both.
Thank you. Open government is better government.
And much more still ahead on the Florida Roundup later in the hour. SpaceX blasts off from Kennedy Space Center with an all-civilian crew. That's later. But up next, could standardized tests finally be on the way out for Florida kids? That's coming up. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for supporting Public Radio. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, how about this, everyone? Could standardized testing finally be on the way out in Florida classrooms? Governor DeSantis has proposed new legislation that would do away, basically, with annual testing in Florida public schools. Now, under this proposal, this current school year would be the last one for the Florida Standards Assessments, or FSAs as they're called. DeSantis made the announcement Tuesday.
I think it'll be something that's very friendly to parents. I think it'll be something that the teachers will appreciate because they'll be able to make adjustments and really focus on the unique needs of each individual student.
Now, schools would replace FSA testing with a system of progress monitoring throughout the academic year. It's already in place, quite frankly. Former Governor Jeb Bush implemented standardized testing in Florida a couple of decades ago. The argument then was that they were needed to improve education. What do you think, folks? Are you a teacher, a parent, maybe? Have you heard an earful from your child about that high-stakes standardized test at school? What do you think about junking the tests? Give us a call, Florida, 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. As we welcome Andrew Spahr, president of the Florida Education Association, and also joining us, Leslie Postal, K-12 education reporter at the Orlando Sentinel. Good to have you both.
Thanks for having us.
Andrew, let's begin with you. The FEA has long called for phasing out standardized tests for Florida students. So what's your reaction to this?
We're very pleased that the commissioner and the governor have listened to educators and parents in the state of Florida. Not only have we, as the Florida Education Association and our local unions across the state, been advocating for moving away from a single test where they set this artificial bar and expect students to reach it regardless of where the student is starting their learning. But so have parents, so have administrators and superintendents and school boards. So the entire school community has really been saying for many, many years now that we should move away from a single test given at one point in the year. And this move towards this progress monitoring approach is something educators have been doing since the beginning of time, you know, where we see where our students are at the beginning of the year. We then base our instruction off of where students are. And then we have a check-in in the middle of the year. And then at the end of the year, look back and see, did the student make growth and did they get where we want them to be? That is a logical way to approach it. Now, there's still a lot of work ahead of us, but this was a good announcement and something we were glad to continue to work with the commissioner and the Department of Education on making happen.
Teachers, parents, kids, nobody's liked the tests really for quite some time. What do you think, though, about the timing of this announcement, Andrew, that a governor who's been taking some criticism over the way he's handled the pandemic in Florida schools has come out with this announcement now?
Well, I think we have to realize that it has to go through a legislative process, and the legislative session work begins next week in Tallahassee with the first committee meetings that are going to start next week. And so you know, obviously what we intend to do is work with lawmakers, work with the commissioner and the Department of Education to really make sure that we end up with a product that has teacher voice and professional voice in it that really helps kids. And that should be our ultimate goal. How do we help kids? You know, again, this idea of a snapshot one test at the end of the year that's not really connected to everything that's going on in the schools and for the progress that students make during the year is not a fair assessment. And so we really do hope that this is an opportunity for us to really talk about how we measure student learning in a way that truly helps students learn and helps us as educators do everything we can to make sure that every child is successful, regardless of race, background, or zip code.
Now, they used to be known as the FCAT, then they became known as the FSAs. Florida, let us know your thoughts about phasing out standardized testing in schools. Could happen. 305-995-1800. Leslie Postal at the Orlando Sentinel. You know, Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran says this decision was made because the COVID pandemic has demonstrated that, in his words and the governor's words, the FSAs are outdated, no longer necessary. They said they realized in the pandemic that just monitoring students' progress throughout the year was working. So what about that?
Well, like Andrew said, I mean, teachers have been using progress monitoring and school districts have been doing that for quite a while. So it's really not something new. I think the big question in all this is, you know, just because you get rid of the FSA and replace it with these smaller tests, what about all the high stakes? And they haven't really answered that. I mean, keep in mind, in Florida, testing is tied to promotion to fourth grade, high school graduation, teacher evaluation, school grades. And so I think there is some worry that if you're still tying all that to progress monitoring instead of an end of the year test, you haven't really fully solved what a lot of critics most worry about. So to me, that's really what needs to be answered. And we just don't have an answer to that yet.
Allison tweets the Florida Roundup. She says the problem with the FSA is that teachers were teaching the test instead of just teaching. For once, DeSantis seems to be doing something positive for children in Florida. I hope he doesn't think this will make up for everything else, she says. 305-995-1800, Robert in Boca Raton. Hi, Robert. How are you? Thanks for calling.
Oh, good. I just was listening to the radio, and the subject came up, so I thought I'd drop my 2 cents.
Sure.
I have two young college students who recently are starting college. So, you know, we've been through this whole testing thing over and over. And when I asked the kids about the test, I'm trying to say how to say this politely.
Yeah.
They said that the test was super easy, bare minimum, and any kid with a problem with it, well, it's probably someone with a problem.
Oh, wow. But they didn't like the test. Did they not mind the test?
They really didn't complain about it. And I have one other situation now. My son is 19 now, but when he was maybe, I think, fifth grade or something, and we were going through the divorce, and things are very tumultuous. His teacher was going to give a D, but he took the test and got basically 100% on it.
Hmm.
So I think it was very useful that it got rid of the subjectiveness of the teacher.
Okay.
Gave them, you know, a fair playing field. Aside from that, when they got older, basically the kids laughed and said the thing was just like a joke. It was so easy.
Interesting. Well, you got some smart kids. Thanks for the call. And you know, Leslie, that's an interesting anecdote from that parent. I have to tell you, though, the majority of the time, what we hear from parents and teachers is great frustration with standardized testing, feeling that they cause students a lot of anxiety, that a school's rating, even its funding, is tied to the scores that a school gets. And
right.
So how will this change if teachers and schools are measured in a different way?
Yeah, that's what we don't know. And I have asked the Florida Department of Education, and they said answers are coming, but they have not provided them yet. So, right, we don't know how school grades might work, how, you know, third grade retention and promotion might work, high school graduation might work. We just don't know how those will be tied to these new tests. I think the hope is, as Andrew said, you know, that there will be a lot less stress on students by just taking these small mini tests rather than something that, as the caller said, for some students is not a big deal, but for some is a high stakes, and it prevents them from going to fourth grade or maybe earning a diploma, or at least puts the, you know, a lot of anxiety on them about whether they will earn that diploma. So, you know, there's but we just don't know what's happening with those high mm-hmm. stakes and how that would work.
305-995-1800. Sue on the line in Tavernier, Florida. Sue, hey, thanks for calling the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. Yeah, I too am concerned about the high stakes continue to be attached to these progress monitoring tests. Because I think there's a thing called Campbell's Law that says that, you know, basically if you reward people for jumping through a hoop, then they're going to disrupt their system and just train to jump through that hoop. And that's what we've seen schools do. The reason schools have progress monitoring in the first place was because they were progress monitoring to see if the kids would be able to pass the test at the end of the year. And so now I'm concerned that we're going to have progress monitoring to see if the kids can pass the progress monitoring, and that won't decrease the amount of testing. That actually could increase it.
Hmm.
And then, you know, just simply the amount of data that's being collected on kids is also a question.
Thank you, Sue. Andrew Spahr, what about those concerns?
So let me say this first. You know, I have a daughter who just graduated from high school. She's now at Howard University in D.C. And I have another daughter who's in seventh grade at Ormond Beach Middle School in Volusia County. And I will say this, my daughter, my seventh grader, when I told her that they were going to end FSA, she was so excited. Of course, when I told her it wasn't until next year, she was a little less excited. She would have liked it to have ended now. But to Sue's point, and to really what Leslie was talking about as well, I think it's really important. Here's what we need to make sure happens. And this is why educators need to be part of this conversation. We need to make sure that the testing is done in such a way with, you know, we know we're going to be moving to a statewide progress monitoring system, and districts do progress monitoring now, and teachers have always done progress monitoring, may not have called it that. But we want to make sure that at the beginning of the year, we have an assessment that determines based on what kids need to know for that grade level, third grade, fourth grade, sixth grade, whatever it might be, what do they know at that point? And then we want to be able to go throughout the year and check. And that way we're tailoring instruction to those students. And then the benchmark in the middle of the year, again, is a diagnostic to see, are the students moving in the right direction? It's going to help us have conversations with parents, because it truly is teachers and parents who need to work together for a child to be successful. And so we'll have conversations with parents and guardians about where kids are and what else we can do to make sure they're on track. And then the end of the year assessment, to everyone's point, cannot become an assessment that's just, it's an end of the year, did they hit a bar? It's got to look at student growth. And if we do that, then it doesn't have the high stakes pressure on it. It's something we're mapping throughout the year, and it's not a one-shot deal. And if we approach this the right way, which is why we want to be part of the conversation with the DOE, with the commissioner, with lawmakers, to make sure that we truly end up with a system that looks at student growth in comparison to the standards and really helps map out how students should proceed and what interventions and supports may be necessary to make sure that every child is learning. That's what we've got to move towards, that kind of system. So again, we too wanna make sure we answer the questions about how are we gonna be grading schools on this? How are we evaluating teachers? How are we dealing with promotion and retention, and do it in a way that isn't disruptive to the overall education system as we believe FCAT and FSA were.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. And we're taking calls from across the state about the governor's announcement this week that he'd like to put forth legislation that would essentially do away with standardized testing in Florida. What do you think? 305-995-1800. Daryl in Tampa has thoughts. Hi, Daryl. Thanks for calling in.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I'm calling to see where does Florida rank amongst the 50 states in terms of secondary education, and how are we leveraging other states that are ahead of us to make sure that we're putting in a system that's going to move us up in the ranking versus creating our own system. Why would we want to do that? Why don't we just benchmark someone that's better than us?
Okay, thanks, Daryl. Leslie Postal, you cover K-12 education for the Orlando Sentinel. How do we compare?
Well, it depends what benchmark you're looking at. Certainly some on academic achievement were pretty high. You know, the state just was touting the Education Week's Quality Counts report, and I think it said we're third in K-12 achievement. That is based on some tests taken in 2019, so it's a little outdated, but you know, by that measure, we do pretty well. By others, maybe not so well. But, you know, it's hard to say what, it really depends what you're looking at. But certainly the state, based on test scores, has made progress in the last two decades.
Here's a tweet from a listener, Andrew Spar. Denise says, the reason the kids are stressed about the tests is because the teachers and administrators are relying on the results for their very livelihood. The issue is not the test itself, it's the punitive way the test results are used. Andrew, this announcement presumably would do away with that kind of punitive system, right?
Well, so here's where we still have work to do, and that's why I keep coming back to that, because we don't have all of the answers. What I would say is that the issue with FSA and FCAT is it was one test given at one time, everything wrote on it. If we're looking at a progress monitoring kind of situation, then you have work going on in throughout the entire year. And so in theory, it should be a more fair system to look at how students are progressing and, quite honestly, the work that we're doing in our schools. Our teachers do amazing work every day, as do our administrators and those who work in our public schools. They make miracles happen every day. And the problem is that what we've been doing for the last 20 plus years in Florida is we've been rating everyone based on this one snapshot as opposed to the work throughout the year. So again, if we approach this the right way, then we have a chance here to really look at the work that's going on throughout the entire year. Yes, we still have concerns about this idea of basing teacher pay and teacher evaluations.
Yeah, I mean, could progress monitoring be used in that way, I think is the question, the way the FSA is now?
And I think the answer is yes, if we're not careful. And that's why, again, the work is still ahead. This was an announcement to kick off work that has to happen during this legislative session. And again, we want to and intend on being a part of all of that work, as I'm sure superintendents and school boards and others want to be as well. We should all be part of this work.
Let's get one more call in quickly. It's Bert in Oldsmar. Hi, Bert. You're on the Florida Roundup.
Yes, thank you. I'm questioning here, taking into account the behavior of Governor DeSantis in this COVID emergency. I really am compelled to take into account his judgment. I really question it, whether he's acting in the absolute well-being of the students. And I'd like to see a proposal, if necessary, put forth not by people affiliated with associations and groups, but by professional managers.
All right, Bert, thanks for your thoughts. You know, we're out of time on this segment, but it's really a huge story for Florida. It affects so many families. It could really change the way we teach students. And I want to thank Andrew Spahr, president of the Florida Education Association, and Leslie Postal, covering K through 12 ed at the Orlando Sentinel. Thanks so much to you both.
Thanks, Melissa.
Sure, thanks.
And still to come, blast off. SpaceX rockets off from the Kennedy Space Center this week with an all-civilian crew. That's next. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is off today. Well, this week, all eyes were on an historic space mission that launched from the Kennedy Space Center. The private aerospace company SpaceX sent an all-civilian crew into orbit as part of their Inspiration 4 mission.
Inspiration 4 is go for launch. Punch it, SpaceX.
The crew will spend 3 days in space aboard the Crew Dragon capsule. Now, the mission was made possible with help from NASA. This launch marks a brand new chapter for commercial space travel. Let us know your thoughts about SpaceX. 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Brandon Byrne covers space for WMFE in Orlando, and he has some thoughts. Brendan, I know it's been exciting for you this week. What was it like to watch this launch?
I'll tell you what, Melissa, I've been covering space for about 7 or 8 years, and as a lifelong Floridian, I've seen launches for my entire life, and this was probably the best-looking launch I have seen ever. It was just absolutely spectacular out here at Kennedy Space Center, and the story behind the launch was even more spectacular than the views. It was just an exciting experience all around.
Let's talk about the story. Of course, billionaire Elon Musk founded SpaceX nearly 20 years ago. Tell us more about the company and what they hope to accomplish with this Inspiration 4 mission.
Yeah, that's right, Melissa. SpaceX was started, two decades ago, and Elon Musk is not shy about the reasons why he started this company. It's to make humans in interplanetary species, to live and work on places other than Earth. And everything that Elon and SpaceX, that they do is to get the company and humanity closer and closer to that goal. So the commercial crew, I'm sorry, the Crew Dragon capsule that the Inspiration4 crew are in, that was built for NASA to help get astronauts to the International Space Station. But it's also designed to get regular people like this crew into space and to learn about how regular human beings behave and how they react to being in space. They're also building a massive rocket in Texas that's going to be used to take humans to the surface of the moon and eventually take SpaceX and passengers to Mars. So everything that they do is towards this goal of getting people onto other planets.
Tell us about NASA's role in all of this. Did SpaceX pay for NASA's help? How did all of that come together?
So this is kind of the culmination of probably a decade or more worth of work on NASA's end to really commercialize space exploration. So the capsule that this crew is in was designed for NASA to transport those NASA astronauts. But it came after the end of the space shuttle program, and NASA needed to get its astronauts up to the space station, but they didn't want to build a new vehicle. They'd rather purchase seats, almost like an Uber, with some other company to get them there, and they can really be, you know, kind of hands-off on this. So during that commercial crew program, NASA paid about $2 billion to SpaceX for this capability and to help design the capsule, but it wasn't their capsule. It's SpaceX's capsule. At the Kennedy Space Center, NASA leases out the property to SpaceX to actually launch there. And NASA really had a very hands-off approach on this. It cost SpaceX only about $1 million to NASA to get this off. They kind of supported certain fueling aspects, certain security things, but really this was a SpaceX show. And that's the point. That's what NASA wants to do. They want commercial companies to take on these responsibilities of getting people off the planet. And that way NASA can step back and do some bigger long-term things.
Yeah, you spoke with NASA's head of human space flight, Kathy Leaders, ahead of the big launch on your radio show. It's called Are We There Yet? Let's listen.
This is what we were dreaming about. We're dreaming about us one day being able to enable a capability that the public can use.
So is this then a milestone in the whole idea, Brendan, of just average Joes eventually being able to hop a rocket ride into space?
You know, I like to be optimistic and say yes, but probably not. I mean, a regular Joe can go if you've got enough money, Melissa.
Yeah. So, yeah. By the way, let's talk about how expensive it. Tell us about the crew and how expensive commercial spaceflight will be for civilians.
So, I mean, commercial spaceflight is really still in its infancy. I mean, we've seen some really cool things happened this year. We watched Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos and their two private space tourism companies take off and go to the edge of space and back. We're seeing this Inspiration4 mission to orbit. But right now it's really, really expensive. So that first seat on Jeff Bezos's flight was like in the millions of dollars. And Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic is charging hundreds of thousands of dollars for a ticket to go to space for just mere minutes. We don't know how much this SpaceX mission cost billionaire Jared Isaacman. We think he's kind of made some mention that it was around or under $200 million. But it's not like you and I are going to be able to charter a flight anytime soon, Melissa, and go up to space. You're still going to need those people to be able to pay.
I know you're probably more upset about that than I am, Brendan. I bet you'd love to go.
I'm a little bit upset.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. As we talk with Brendan Byrne, space reporter at WMFE in Orlando, about the big SpaceX launch this week at the Kennedy Space Center. What do we know about this crew that was aboard the Inspiration4 crew?
The crew is really cool, Melissa. So we mentioned this billionaire Jared Isaacman. He chartered this from SpaceX. He made his money through a payment processing company that he started called Shift4. And he wanted to raise money for an organization. So he picked St. Jude Children's Research Center. And St. Jude picked the first participant outside of Jared as Haley Arsenault. She's a 29-year-old childhood cancer survivor, a physician assistant, and currently in orbit right now. And so she joined on the mission. And then Jared held two different competitions. One of them was kind of like a Shark Tank competition, you know, who could use his platform. And Cyan Proctor, Dr. Cyan Proctor, was selected. She's a geologist. She's an educator. And she also applied to be a NASA astronaut, but was never selected. And so she is now in space on this mission. And then the fourth was picked through essentially a raffle. If you donated to St. Jude, you got in a raffle. And Chris Zambrowski, his friend, actually won and decided to give the ticket to Chris. So he's an aerospace engineer and an Air Force veteran. So really, there's kind of like somebody for everybody up there to look up to and see, oh, these people, they made it to space. They're really inspirational.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, they are currently in orbit. What about the return and splashing back down to Earth?
Yeah, so they're spending about 3 days in orbit, and they will splash down off the coast of Florida. There's seven different splashdown sites they could go to from the Gulf side to the Atlantic coast. We're not sure exactly when they're coming back. It looks like it's going to be tomorrow night, maybe into Sunday morning. But it'll be quite spectacular. I mean, the Crew Dragon capsule is a capsule that splashes down into the ocean, which is very new for folks here in the U.S. For space flight. So it'll definitely be interesting to see them come back and maybe even catch a glimpse of it if you're close enough to the coast.
Sure. And what can we expect when it comes to more of these kinds of all civilian space flights, whether they are from SpaceX, Virgin Atlantic, or even another player?
Yeah, so another mission from SpaceX is going to be happening the end of this year, possibly early next year. It's actually taking a crew of civilians to the International Space Station and back. And again, this was intentional by NASA to kind of open up its different platforms to commercial usage. So now tourists can visit the International Space Station. So that's happening. We're going to start seeing Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic again, taking on these tourism missions. But again, there is a market for it, but it's very, very expensive. So we can expect to see some of these, but I don't think we're going to see, you know, these things taking off as frequently as, say, a commercial airliner or anything like that. So we're still a long ways away from that, Melissa.
And you mentioned this frees up, this kind of public-private partnership frees up NASA to work on other projects. What are they?
Yeah, so NASA's really big project right now is called Artemis, and this is the return of humans to the lunar surface, the first time since the Apollo mission. And in mythology, Artemis is Apollo's twin sister. So we are looking at the first flight of Artemis the end of this year, possibly early next year, from Kennedy Space Center, this massive rocket that that NASA's building, this brand new capsule that's going to take humans to the moon. And there will be, after this first flight, you know, crew on it. But the next flight is going to take a crew of NASA astronauts on a trip around the moon and back, followed by the third mission of Artemis, which is going to take humans back to the surface of the moon. And it's just absolutely incredible to see how quickly how this is coming together this year. And it's because NASA doesn't have to worry about the little things anymore. They don't have to worry about getting their astronauts to and from the International Space Station or cargo up. They rely on the commercial companies to do that. That way they can look at these big goals like putting humans back on the moon.
Fascinating stuff. And I know it's been a wild week for you. Brendan Byrne, covering the space program from Central Florida at WMFE in Orlando. And from people watching all up and down the beaches, they said it was glorious, Brendan. So thanks so much for joining us with your great insights into this big launch. We so appreciate you being with us.
My pleasure, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and it will be so fascinating, too, to see that Artemis launch that Brendan talked about going back to the moon, folks. NASA going back to the moon from right here in Florida. Man, oh, man, it's always interesting living in this state, isn't it, everybody? Thanks so much for listening today. This is our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Podomer are show producers. Catherine Hobbs is the associate producer. WLRN's director of radio operations and technical director is Peter Mertz, with engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for calling, listening, and tweeting the show. Be safe, everyone. We'll be back next Friday at noon.